Yeah, so, Senator Gordley.
Today's the last year.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. They are numbered LC 2212, 2559, 2647, 2776, 2847, 3283, 3299, and 3375. The committee has the list and a brief explanation of each draft, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Gordley moves LCs, and I don't know if I'm in the same order or not, but 2212, 2559, 2647, 2776, 2847, 3283, 3299, and 3375. Discussion. Senator Corcoran.
Yes, Mr. Chair, as usual, do you know who the proponents of 2559, 2647, and 2847 are?
I can answer a few of those questions. 2559 was at the request of, and I believe, if I remember the association correctly, it's Oregon Telecom Association. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's who it was.
Oregon Telecom?
Yeah.
Okay.
2647, that was at the request of a constituent of mine. And
why isn't the constituent's name on the react request?
Well, because it would require me to go back at home in my files and find his name. I haven't had a chance to do that yet, Senator Corcoran. That seems how it just came out today.
Okay.
And 2847 was brought forward by the Senate President's Office. Is that correct?
What a surprise. I would guess that's correct.
That's a good guess. I don't know. So those three will be at the request of the Senate Business, Labor, and Economic Development Committee.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Objections? So ordered. Thank you.
Attorney General strike now.
Yeah. I saw that. I wondered about that. I think they are.
Senator Nelson, was he going to have something else to say? I don't remember.
No.
Okay. Well, you know, that's a mixed question of constructability. I mean, there's some that will argue that leave it in the hands of an arbitrator who's a typical.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Mr. Putman, when you're ready, you can introduce the bill to us.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 239, brought to us by Senator Nelson at the request of the mayor of Permiston. And there's a problem that affects cities and other property owners as well, and it has to do not primarily but often with abandoned mobile homes and other vehicles on property. And getting rid of them requires, in the case of registered vehicles and trailers, access to the title. And this bill creates a method for getting title to that. And when there's personal property inside of them, these vehicles, it also allows whoever's going to dispose of it title to that internal personal property. Now, the mayor of Permiston told me that he could not come down. It's Daniel Hill, and I believe in your packets you have from him an affidavit explaining how he comes to know of this problem. Two people have come forward indicating that while they're in agreement with the objective and believe it can be accomplished, that the bill does require some technical work to get the language in conformity with other property transfer statutes and to clarify the process for getting title to motor vehicles, etc. And I believe they plan on working with Mr. Hill and others in getting that accomplished. Those two problems just came to light today, although I did know that Mr. Hill wouldn't be able to be here.
Thank you. Now, is he mayor, or it says in his, I'm reading his testimony, it says that he is, has been elected municipal judge and
okay.
Currently a circuit judge.
Municipal judge, yes,
okay.
My mistake.
Okay, make sure we correct that for the record. Committee members, in your packet, there should be the affidavit from Daniel Hill. And do we have a sign-up sheet? Anybody else wants to talk on the bill?
Simple page away. Is there a, maybe we're going to find out, just an overall statute dealing with abandoned personal property, is that what he's referring to? Is that ever sent to something that's consistent across the board, or?
I'm not sure.
He just says mobile homes, travel trailers, et cetera, but.
I would think there must, I'm sure ODOT can probably answer that question, and they're here to talk about it. So should we start with Kelly, or?
Sure.
Sure, Mr. Kelly, you want to go first? Senator Harper had a question for you, if you don't have anything you're prepared to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. I'd be happy to answer the senator's question first, and then just put the little bit on record that I talked to Senator Nelson's office about.
Okay, I'm just, we don't have a statute that just deals with everything in general, personal property, like vehicles. I see we're naming all these by name. Seems to me a generic statute, but do that anybody's benefit, or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, I'm not that familiar, to tell you the truth, with all of the different abandoned law stuff and what is personal property and what isn't. The only piece I'm really familiar with is when it's actually a vehicle or something that we've titled. You know, this bill contains things about, you know, a person's contents of their home and things like that, and getting titled that, which a court would have to issue. So I honestly don't know. I know that there's some other folks in the room that are more familiar with this, and perhaps they can answer that. But I think they've tried to follow along and make this look similar, but there are some differences, and that's what the technical amendments that Mr. Putnam was talking about. When I talked to the senator's office this morning, I went to see Senator Nelson's office this morning, and I talked to Alice Nelson, and I told her, I said, you know, there's a part in here towards the last of the bill, I think it's in Section 8 on page 7, it talks about, yeah, Section 8, page 7 of the bill, kind of like in lines 41 through 45, it's talking about a person getting a lien later on. If they didn't get notice, that they could come back and within so many months get a lien. And my only comment to Alice was, in order for that to really be an effective lien, if it's on the vehicle or the travel trailer, the manufactured structure travel trailer, that lien should really be recorded on the title with the department, because otherwise nobody will know where to look for it, or that it even exists. If all you did, you can go to the court and get a lien on property today, but unless it gets recorded on the title, you know, it's not very effective. So it's just small things like that to try to make some things consistent. I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble of getting a lien, you might as well have it recorded properly. You know. You know.
Makes sense.
So
I think, Mr. Chair, if we identify these things, that council can take a crack at fixing those.
Yeah, I mean, that was really the only thing I saw. You know, I was at first concerned when I, Mr. Chair and Harper, I was first concerned early in the bill when I saw that you would get that the judge would be issuing a title to the contents. I thought, golly, you know, we don't have any way of dealing with personal property like microwaves or whatever the heck might be left behind in this trailer. You know, we only title vehicles. But then I read closer, it's the court that's actually issuing you title to that. I don't know what that title looks like. But then the court's also ordering transfer of title to the vehicle. And that, I can understand, they would be, we get that today where people submit a paper from a court saying, you know, this vehicle used to be owned by Kelly Taylor and now it's owned by, you know, Mr. Harper, you know. So that happens today, so that looked okay early on in the bill. It was just the part about recording the lien later on that I wanted to bring for food for thought for the committee.
Senator Hook?
And this refers to everything that B&B titles. You title all of these things, mobile homes, travel trailers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Harper, we do title mobile homes, well, manufactured structure mobile homes, they get called those things. They're not really mobile anymore. and then we do title travel trailers. We don't title the contents, somebody's personal property inside of a travel trailer or manufactured structure like furniture and stuff. No, we don't title that.
So consistency would be anything that's titled that meets this criteria. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's
all.
The appliances and things like that that are inside of a manufactured home, are those noted on, or when you don't know when it's titled, it's just the frame and the walls and the roof?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It does not include the appliances because those can be removed. Those are personal property.
Okay. Do you have more?
That was it, Mr. Chair. That was all I wanted to bring to your attention that I told Alice I would.
Okay.
So. Thank you.
Thank you. Emily Siddeley.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Emily Siddeley with Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, a statewide association of rental property owners and managers. Following, I believe it was the 1995 session, we had a member in Eastern Oregon who identified that they had a tenant who had gotten involved in some ill times of poor finances and had a horse, a mobile home, and a truck, but they had no trailer for the horse. They put the horse inside the mobile home, hooked the truck to the mobile home, and proceeded to try and tow it away when the horse fell through the floor and impaled itself on the superstructure, and then died. At that point, that was August, we found then that there was no statutes to deal with the contents of the structure. There was a very poor way of dealing with the mobile home. And so we, in the Coalition of Landlords and Tenants, for the next three sessions, worked on 90425 and 90675, which are the abandoned properties sections for mobile homes. When I look at this bill, I can understand the intent, but it doesn't get us there because we're using too many different terms. There's descriptions of things that don't happen, such as issuing title to the personal property that's inside. And I would like the opportunity to work with legislative council to try and solve the problem that this arises, but put it more in the lines of what we've already done with landlord-tenant statute. I am aware of mobile homes and manufactured dwellings being abandoned by haulers on public land and private land because they haven't gotten paid as a hauler. So it's not a landlord-tenant relationship, and the way I understand it, there is no way to get rid of those right now. But this, what we just need is a shorter time frame and then follow the whole sequence that we've spent 7 years in identifying where all the problems are so we get the words in the right order and get the process in the right order. This has the court doing things that the court doesn't normally do. There's already a prescribed process and a pre-done form within the court system for abandoned structures, so we could streamline this so you didn't have to have a vast amount of attorneys trying to figure out what to do with this statewide.
Thank you. So some of you are willing to work on this with the proponents of the bill? And
yes, very definitely.
With a solution, possibly?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Is that Sean?
Sean Scott?
Sean Scott? Not right. Okay. Is anybody else here? Is anybody here that signed up and wanted to testify? All right. Somebody bailed out on us, I guess.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, also your staff measure summary indicates a potential fiscal impact. We received a fiscal impact statement, which says that the Department of Justice thinks that this statute would seldom be used and wouldn't therefore cause them significant problems. Well, what they actually said is the number of new suits transferring title of vehicles is indeterminate, that they could have a significant effect on court expenditures, but there's no way to actually predict that. Secondly, Department of Transportation believes if this business of the title transfer can be fixed, they can handle that with existing staff.
Okay. Well, seeing no one else wants to testify in the bill, well, it asked Motor Vehicle Division and Multifamily Housing to work with Senator Nelson's office and come up with some amendments. Thank you. Close the public hearing.
Okay.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 136.
Mr. Chairman, in many respects, this bill is like the former one. The proponent of the bill is in Chicago and could not get here today. What they're trying to do is ask Oregon to conform to model statutes about trademark registration. And as it turns out, Oregon is actually in front of the Model Act, and in conversations between the Corporation Division and the proponents of this bill, they're quite willing to work together, and as I understand it, the association that's after this is going to put some of ordinance language into future model acts. So I did send to you the information from the International Trademark Association, and I did ask Tom Rausch with the Secretary of State's office to come, and he knows far more about this than I do, and I don't know that he has written testimony that can tell you what they plan to do to make it right.
Okay. We have a Senate sheet also.
And I do have a fiscal impact statement on this as well, which I'll hand out.
Well, no.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. Members of the committee, for the record, I am Tom Rausch, representing the Secretary of State Corporation Division. Excuse me. I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify before you on Senate Bill 136. As Mr. Putman indicated, we have talked with the proponents of the measure, and we're neutral on this bill, but we want to make it work with the system we have right now, and the proponent of the measure, Mr. Fayer, has agreed that what we are talking about is admirable and, in fact, achieves the ideals of the Model Act legislation. And, in fact, if we can get good language on the media, neutral language that we'd like to put in there, we'd like to propose that to be part of the Model Act. Just real briefly, I want to point out a couple things that are concerned for our office, and that is that the bill changes the several of the filing requirements language from shall, the Secretary of State shall do this or shall not allow this, and turns it into may. So it creates some uncertainty for full filers, and especially from our perspective, from a filing office, we don't know what we're supposed to do according to the legislation. So we'd like to put that back into shall language, where it's been for a number of years and works very well. And in fact, the according to Mr. Fayer, the Model Act legislation wanted to make states run through the review of these filings and did not require that in the model language because they're afraid states would balk at that. You know, we do that now, and we're happy and comfortable with the process as it is.
Do you know if that was the proponent's wish to go from shall to may, or is that just a drafting style by legislative council?
That was actually, I believe, Chairman Beyer, that was the Model Act language, and they just transferred Model Act language into our statutes, as I understand it. Again, in conversation with Mr. Fayer in Chicago, he said that he would rather have it shall, but would not. They didn't put that into our bill because they thought states preferred it as may. And in fact, we don't prefer it may. Oregon likes to be a little ahead of the pack, I guess.
Okay.
The other thing I just wanted to note, one section of the bill on page 5, lines 40 through 50, and additionally in one other minor area, the bill talks about photocopies and writings and is really taking a step back, in our opinion, in terms of requiring paper. And as you know, the Electronic Signatures and Global National Commerce Act, e-sign, and the Model Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, which is before the legislature this session, both of them are saying filing offices get out of the way and accept electronic records and do things electronically, or at least in a medium-neutral fashion. And we are 100% behind that. We always have been, and we are proposing then to work with your staff and legislative council to amend the language here so that we become media neutral rather than require paper. And so I don't have any amendments for you today. I apologize for that. It's been kind of a quick session. But I would, if you wish to go further with this bill, I would be happy to work with staff that we can get some amendments drafted that will be pleasing to everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We have another sign-up sheet for Senate Bill 136. I don't think there is, Mr. Chairman. I want to call your attention to the fact that we do now have a fiscal impact statement on this. And, no, I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong bill. Never mind.
We do have a fiscal impact statement, anyway.
Which is zero.
Yeah.
Well, no, that's on 4/27.
Oh, well.
How can you make the same mistake I made?
I see, okay. I got the wrong fiscal. All right. Does anybody else want to talk about it? Thank you. Public hearing. And just you work with the sponsors of the bill to give it something back.
The last transmission we got from this guy had a virus on his mind.
Okay. Well, let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 4/27. People are headed up here, so they must know.
Mr. Chairman, this is to try to clarify what the phrase 6 months means. It has to do with when employers have to start withholding retirement funds from an employee's paycheck. It is possible to read the law two different ways, that's the way PERS is handling it, two different ways. And this is an attempt to make it uniform throughout. I want to call to your attention that fiscal is unable to determine what impact this would have on non-state PERS employers, and I'm hoping that folks from DAS and PERS can answer that for us.
Thank you. Whenever you're ready, please.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is John Radford. I'm Administrator of the State Controller's Division here. And we're requesting or seeking your help in solving a little ambiguity or clarity issue with respect to ORS statutes. One statute provides that an employee becomes a member of PERS following 6 full months of service, and I think the key that we've been using for many, many decades in the Oregon State payroll system is a full 6 months of service. PERS sometime ago back in the 70s created another statute that is states that salary shall be considered earned when it is paid, and the date inscribed in the warrant or check shall be considered the pay date. So in practical terms, what happens for us is we've got our interpretation, which is saying that before we start making PERS contributions on behalf of an employee, a new member of state service, we're required to wait a full 6 months before we make those contributions. Under the PERS interpretation, it's date driven. And so let me give you an example of how that would work. Suppose we have a new employee that begins work on the first full working day of January and works through June. That to us would mean that would be the full 6 months wait service. That employee would go to work on the first work day of July, work throughout July, and on August 1st then would be on his or her paycheck would have the PERS contribution starts for earnings for July. So there would be no contributions for that person from the first working day of January through June 30th. PERS, on the other hand, would take the position based on their language in the statutes that says, well, the employee started on first working day of January, worked through June 30th, and that would be his or her six-month wait, and on July 1, that employee would become a member of PERS, and because you paid that employee on July 1 for June earnings, therefore, PERS contributions are required to being paid. So in that case, there'd only be a five-month wait when it comes to PERS contributions. So that's our problem, two different interpretations. Now, we've always operated on the basis of a full six-month period. That goes back for many, many years, many decades. And so when you look at the fiscal impact for the state of Oregon, there'd be no impact for the state of Oregon, because we're proposing that language that clarifies here in the bill would require make it very clear that there's a six-month waiting period. So there'd be no fiscal impact because we would just continue doing business as usual. However, if we were to take the date sequence perspective, the PERS statute, and say that's paramount, then there would be a financial impact. There would be, by one estimate, a $5 to $20 million payout period at the PERS level. And then for our contributions, up to maybe 3.6 is calculated by DAS, 3.6 million additional PERS contributions because of the hiring that goes on during the year. So we're here to try to get that clarified and make it clear to us so there is no ambiguity, there is no uncertainty as to what the legislative intent here is. And, of course, we're asking for your help to pass this bill. That clarifies that. We've worked with DOJ attorneys and the Department of Justice attorneys and worked with the Legislative Council on the appropriate language that needs to make this very clear for us.
Thank you. Okay.
When you refer to 6 full months, am I correct in assuming that you mean 6 full calendar months?
6 full calendar months, that's correct, Keith and Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
It's not 30 days or 31, it's full calendar months.
Full calendar 6 months worth of earnings, right.
So the only people that would affect them are those people who are not hired on.
If a person was hired mid-month, then we wouldn't count that first mid-month time as a month. It would be the following month where the clock starts ticking. And so we'd go 6 months from that date. That's correct.
Okay. Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon. As I understand it, if the discrepancy in statute is allowed to continue, according to your testimony, there could be a $5 million to $20 million payout. What is that estimate based on, and which state agencies would be affected, just so that we have a better understanding of what the impact could be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, members of the committee, I think probably in this case PERS would be the best source of information on that. PERS is the entity that calculated that, estimating a $5 to $20 million impact on contribution payouts.
Mr. Radford and Senator Gordley, isn't that $5 to $20 million payout, if I understood you earlier, on non-state employees?
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Mr. Putman, I think PERS would probably, this gets very technical and complex, and I think probably PERS would be in the best position to answer that, because from my understanding, PERS has consistently applied the date sequence for all other non-state members of PERS. Cities, county school districts and other special districts that are members of PERS already have the date sequence, or has for years applied the date sequence. It's only with respect to the state that we have this issue.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. Do we have someone from PERS here this afternoon to clarify?
We do.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, Mr. Delaney from PERS is in the audience and I believe would be more than willing to come up and testify.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. And, yeah, coming up. You didn't sign up to testify, but like we're going to put you on the hot seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Delaney. I'm the manager of government relations at PERS. I didn't sign up to testify as the PERS board has not taken a position on this bill, but I am here to answer questions the committee may have.
We had a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Delaney. Just trying to understand the how you calculated, or did you calculate a possible payout in the $5 million to $20 million range if the discrepancy statute continues?
Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, those were early numbers. This is a very difficult item. The PERS can't pin down specifics to. What we can give you is examples to show you how the number could be arrived at. The reason I mention it's a difficult issue is, as came out in the testimony, this doesn't impact every state employee. It only impacts those state employees whose seventh month happens to fall midweek, and therefore they get their seventh month paycheck in the midweek. For those state employees that their seventh month begins on a weekend, this doesn't impact. So PERS has never searched their database to determine when people's particular payrolls were impacted. However, we just got some information this afternoon from our private actuary, Milliman and Robertson. He says, based on what we have here, he can't give us specific numbers, but he can give us example to apply. He said, taking a member who has a $2,000 per month salary, that you're going to save approximately $309 a month. That would be employer and the employee 6% piece. And there's that savings is included for the state because the state picks up the 6% on behalf of state employees. So you have about a $309 savings per person, and he estimates there are about 5,000 new state employees per year coming onto the payroll, which would equal about $1.5 million. You have about 5,000 new school district members and about 4,000 new local government employees coming on each year. It's PERS understanding that this scenario is one that's limited to the state of Oregon, that there's very few, if any, local government employers that actually encounter this situation of paying their six-month salary in the seventh month. So we don't expect that to play much of an issue with regard to the costs here.
And follow-up, Mr. Chair. Did I hear you say that the PERS position on the bill is neutral?
Correct. Mr. Chair, Senator Gorley, just as a clarification, the PERS Board's Legislation Committee met 2 weeks ago, which is a four-member group of the PERS Board, two labor and two management members. They recommended no position at this point to the full board. The full board itself meets tomorrow and will be considering this bill at that time, but the recommendation, again, from the committee is to take no position. And the reason for that is they consider this to be a benefit issue, a clarification of a benefit issue, and they always defer to the legislature in those issues.
Okay. Now, for my own clarification, you said this only affects anyone if the payday, i.e. the end of the month, falls on a weekend?
It's interesting, Chair. This is the way it goes. Let me give you again that example of the January 1 to June 30th. January 1 to June 30th, you got 6 months completed.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Oregon, if that 30th falls on a Thursday, you get your paycheck the next day, Friday, July 1st. So you're getting your 6 months check paid in the seventh month.
Mm-hmm.
And the legislation says salary is considered earned when paid. So PERS is saying, oh, well, you may have gotten your June salary paid July 1, but we consider it earned when paid as July money contributions are due. Now, if that same individual, January 1 to June 30 in a given year, the 30th was a Friday, the state pays, if the first is going to be in the weekend, the state pays you on the 30th. So that person wouldn't encounter that problem. Their 6 month was paid in the 6 month.
Okay, so now that makes for, I thought you described it other way, I thought, in my mind. But so it doesn't affect if it falls on the weekend.
Correct.
Okay. And so the local government, this doesn't affect them at all because they are all assuming correctly. I'm saying correctly that 6 months means 6 months, and if you wait 6 months.
Mr. Chair, we haven't polled the local governments. This whole issue is one that PERS itself doesn't see in a month-to-month basis because employers simply pay us a lump sum of contributions, and it's not till the end of the year that we attribute. So we don't know when a person's 6 months may have ended and if the proper amount of contributions were being paid, unless a member calls us and says, I'm missing some contributions, please audit my particular record. I just understand from those PERS members or PERS employees that have been around for many years, when this legislation came into effect back in 81, the one that clarifies salaries considered earned when paid, that in that time period, locals were not paying into the next month. It was always an issue that was only encountered with the state of Oregon.
Okay. Any other questions?
One other question, Mr. Chair. If we do not take action on this bill, then and the ambiguity continues, then does that put PERS in the position of possible lawsuits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, that's always possible. If you had a member who is saying that, that the law is being misapplied in some manner, and or an employer, if there is ambiguity in the law, that always can lead to lawsuits.
Senator Corcoran?
Well, just Senator Gordley's benefit, I mean, in the event that you have, typically in collective bargaining agreements, whether it's with the state or with local governments, there is a discussion of PERS benefits and when they began, because while it doesn't impact your typical 40-hour-a-week worker, seasonals, for instance, and there's a bunch of them working for forestry and some of the human resources, they get affected because once they get to their 1,020 hours, then they start getting a benefit in lieu of PERS. And I think that all the treatment, and the agency was in to talk to me about this, all the treatment in the contracts and all the treatment, the sort of the practical side of this is that PERS is intended to go into effect after your 6 months, not when you're paid. Mm-hmm. And so I think that very likely, if I was a sharp local government person, I'd be all over this thing saying, you try to get me, you know, a month earlier than the law requires, and I think it would open it up to lawsuits. That, you know, just my perspective. I think this is a very, you know, logical bill. I think it's amazing in the face of it that PERS would have ever interpreted to mean that we can get you after 5 months because, you know, you, technically you're getting paid on the first month.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Tina, do you have anything you want to add?
Oh, bring her up here, Mr. Chair. We've got some questions for her.
We'll close the public hearing on Section 427.
She doesn't know about that.
And I don't know where the committee is on this bill. It seems like it's something that should be fixed, but I know the Senate President has asked that we deal with PERS as a package and not piecemeal it. So I'm not entirely sure if this fits in that package or not. It's a separate issue, but yet it is dealing with PERS, and I'm a little sensitive after today's firefight on the floor after what I thought was a fairly simple bill.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
Mr.
Yeah, Chair.
If I may say, what happened on the floor today is not a firefight. I think that would be
a miscommunication.
And it's not even a miscommunication, I think, just an exaggeration. I think Senator Hannon was speaking from a historical perspective. He was around in 1977, and he has a history that informed his concern. Mm. And I heard that, and I think we all appreciated that. I have a question, though, and a concern about packaging this piece along with the other...
Let's do an open work session on the bill first and talk about it. Yeah.
I apologize. So,
okay, we're in work session now. Senator Gordley.
Mm-hmm. Just some clarification on what packaging means. The package includes what?
Well, currently, the big bill on PERS includes everything under the sun. That's Senate Bill 134 that's in possession of the committee, and that's, we are in the process of trying to find out what all that package is going to include. I think from the Mary Bach, the conversation with her, I think she's in agreement with 5 of the 6 issues in that bill currently. And speaking of some of the public employees union perspective, the one she's not currently is the third tier provision in that bill. And but we're talking about it still. So I think that, you know, I had intended to, I thought we'd move this bill today, but I think we better wait and talk to Senator Durfer and see what his desires on that issue are and where we're going to end up with that issue. I think this is important, and if we have to run a standalone bill, we can do that, but it may be something that we have to wait and see on that issue. Senator Corcoran.
Well, I wouldn't presume to speak for public employees, but you know, the chance of this packaging notion, and I understand where it's coming from. I'm not quite sure why it's coming in this particular manner, because there's no way you can stack up all the presents on this side and exchange it for Tier 3 and get away with it in the building, I don't think. And I really would, as you go, and I'm obviously, you know, happy with not taking a vote on this, and you can go talk to Senator Kerfler about it, but this is really a technical fix that has nothing to do with the ideology around PERS. And I think that, you know, there's some other stuff. I mean, this whole notion, I know we're not discussing the PERS bill now, but this whole notion that it has to be one big bill and everything's at risk because of that is just really confounds me from a good public policy standpoint. Just it doesn't make any sense to me. This is not horse trading territory on this particular bill. So there's a lot of stuff that the PERS board, I think, really wants and needs. And I've heard Senator Harper and you before talk about this issue of not wanting agencies to come to committees after they've promulgated rules that they then want to get supported by legislation. You know, I understand all that, and I think that's some of what happened with the pooling and some of the other stuff that they told us they couldn't do and then did during the interim. But, you know, to put that together, to think that somehow, you know, we'll hold that in abeyance for Tier 3, I don't think is a political move that's going to happen in the building.
Well, Senator Corcoran, obviously, Senator Durfler has ways he wants to run things at times, and this is his desire on this issue is to try to run one big issue.
How else are we going to get to 700 over this?
I know. So, well, this one, I mean, the other enticement would be this is actually bad for the worker, and the public employee guy even agrees with it.
No, I agree. I think it's a very technical issue, and I would expect one way or another it's going to happen this session. But I think for today we're going to sit on at least for a little while. And we have Wednesday we have let's close the work session first. Wednesday we have a group of bills up again. Probably will take longer than 45 minutes on Wednesday.
Three bills. Hopefully hear more about Senate Bill 485.
Senate Bill 485. A report back from MLAC. They meet on Wednesday also.
Senate Bill 439.
And we were hoping to have an LC on constitutional referral. We didn't get that back.
Constitutional referral.
That's true.
I was told today, Mr. Chairman, by legislative counsel that they were caught up with, quote, Senate stuff, unquote. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that.
They may have got introduced through the committee or something or a different person.
And the other bill on Wednesday has to do with travel agents, if I'm not mistaken.
On Friday again this week, we will not meet.
And that's what
Senator Corcoran take note. That'll be 2 weeks in a row.
But that, no
meeting,
Friday.
No meeting Friday again
this
week. Next Monday.
On behalf of my wife, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next Monday, we have a bill up dealing with video arcades. I've been told by the sponsor of the bill that we're going to expect a crowd. So we may be here for length of time Monday.
Children and videos and...
Are we going to have some machines in here for it to escape the boredom?
As I understand, the video will demonstrate some of the objective material in videos that they'd like you to do something.
Might not be old enough to view it.
There is a reception in the governor's office, I believe, to the committee during that time next Monday. I was notified in my office today from 4:30 to 5:30. So if it looks like we're going to run beyond 5:30, we may adjourn for 15 or 20 minutes. We can go up and say hi up there. And
we don't have any choice in this. Let's see, governor's reception video.
Is there anything else come for the committee? Thank you for attending.
Adjourned.